profession, begotten of long practice and complete familiarity. He was thus able to conduct his part of the service without in the least having to think about what he was saying. He read from his service books the words that were printed there, and he carried out certain actions that were required by the ritual or order of the service. Seldom could we perceive any spiritual thoughts being emitted by the minister such as we should have done. We ought to have observed a flash of light, as his thoughts left him to ascend to him to whom they were directed. But most of all, we should have seen the downpouring of celestial rays that would have indicated beyond all doubt that the prayers had been properly directed, had been received, and that they were being accorded their full acknowledgement. Had the 43 thoughts of the whole congregation, there assembled, been adequately concentrated and emitted, the whole building would have become bathed in the most thrilling galaxy of celestial colors and blends of colors. Supposing the fervor of the congregation to have gradually increased, though this is hardly to be expected in most earthly churches, we should have beheld an immense thought form of the most beautiful shape and color to have enveloped the entire church, to soar up and up into the highest empyrean, a magnificent manifestation of the power of spiritual thought directed to the great source of all. But no, we saw none of these things. What we did see was a feeble flicker of light, as someone tried to marshal his thoughts, a flicker that quickly died down and disappeared, leaving the surroundings in the same state of spiritual gloom as they were before. And the cause? There are several. Chief among this item is the very form of the services themselves. Long, inappropriate recitations from dull and dreary psalms have no spiritual value whatever. The oral recounting of incidents and acts that took place some 2,000 years ago are of no help spiritually. But the recital of prayers so familiar that they can be said without any effort of will at all, leaving the mind free to think of what it likes and that anything but the object in hand, the recital of prayers, the contents of which have little or no interest for, nor application to, the one who is praying, the repetition of incomprehensible creeds, and the droning of vesicles and responses by people who are heedless of what they are saying. Just ponder these matters. Then consider the cringing attitude of mind that is instilled into the churchgoer when he is told that at best he is a miserable sinner, and consider, too, the general air of appeasement to a wrathful God who, supposedly, will bring down condign punishment upon humanity if it misbehaves itself, together with the abject self-abasement that this same strange God demands as his strict right. Just contemplate all this. And then ask yourself, my dear friend, is it to be wondered at that those few churches we visited were just places of gray gloom, whence few prayers, real prayers, ever ascended to the high realms of heaven? What of our personal devotions, you will say, the prayers that we say at home in the privacy of our room? If the formulae of the prayer books can be discarded, then real prayers will have some chance of being said, to the everlasting benefit of the person who says them. But they must be real sensible efforts of thought. First of all, let us forget altogether the stereotyped form of prayer that is familiar to most people, some characteristics of which I have just given you. Let us start afresh, as it were, as though we were approaching the matter for the first time, and so with our minds perfectly free from any conventional notions. 44 Prayer is a grand, sturdy, virile thing, not a cringing, crawling, sanctimonious affair. In our prayers we have something to say. Let us say it in a wholesome, forthright fashion. Let us, of course, show our respect by the courteous way in which we frame our thoughts. We need not use long, ponderous phrases, nor need we use an extreme precocity in choosing our words. We need not, if we wish, employ the rather picturesque, though archaic mode of address in our use of the and the. It is not in the least necessary, and its absence in no way connotes a want of respect and reverence. Your prayers should be the clothing of your thoughts in words, since it is natural for you on the earth plane to transform your thoughts mentally into words. The shortest prayer, consisting of only a few words sincerely intended with the thought fully concentrated and powerfully directed, is far, far better than the grandest, most rhetorical prayer that was ever uttered, if the latter should be merely so many words with scarcely any meaning, without intention, and with no directive force behind it. Such a prayer, in fact, is simply a waste of time. Some of the finest prayers are also the simplest and the shortest. There are not many people upon the earth plane who are able to sustain a prolonged effort of thought directed in prayer. Whatever happens, their minds are bound to wander, sooner or later, and the prayer at once becomes non-existent. With the motive power withdrawn, it will never reach its high destination, nor, indeed, any destination at all. The most efficacious prayer is that from which is eliminated any fulsome flattering recital of the Great Father's attributes. It is a pure survival of paganism and superstition, and it is utterly worthless. It reeks of sycophancy. It suggests that we must first flatter the Father of the universe, as a form of approach, before we make him a request, and judging by the usual lengthy preamble in this fashion that forms the opening to so many of the earth's world's formal prayers, the greater the flattery, the greater are the chances of having the prayer answered. So many earth people cease to be themselves truly when they essay to pray. They seem to think that a prayer book is essential, because, presumably in the eyes of compilers of prayer books, they are completely incapable of expressing themselves upon any subject whatever. They believe that an earnest request for help and guidance must be worded in great lengthy periods more formal and grandiose and ponderous than the most involved state document of ancient days. In short, your prayers should be just as homely, simple, and informal in their constructions as your conversation among your friends, sincere and heartfelt, and 45 shorn of affectations which are not natural to you. And I would add, let them be brief. You are much more likely to be successful with brevity. Of course, you will appreciate that we are not here considering such circumstances as of your being in trouble where the only relief and hope in your mind resides in a protracted outpouring of your troubles to the Great Father. In such cases the circumstances are altogether different. In successful prayer, whether it is said by you upon the earth plane, or by us here in the spirit world, the result is a perfect linking up with the Father of the universe and ourselves. The response will be the same, whether we be in church or out of it. But prayer has a much larger field than is contained within the boundaries with which the people of the earth plane usually circumscribe it. Prayer in its wider sense can spring from our mind spontaneously, aroused from the conditions or circumstances of the moment. The glories of the universe are ever about us here in the spirit world. I have told you of some of them. The joy, for example, that the beholding of beautiful flowers will bring to us becomes in our minds a tegum thanksgiving, which we send to the Creator of all such delights. We do not give such thoughts any formal shape, we do not express ourselves in so many thought words. But we do know we are forever grateful for what is giving us this great joy, and that is prayer also. You can readily imagine how these realms are rendered still more beautiful by the downpouring of light that everlastingly descends upon us in response to our thoughts of happiness and gratefulness. We need no elaborate ritual or ceremonial to convey our gratitude to the Father of the universe for the bounties he so richly showers down upon us. We do not find ourselves tongue-tied and obliged to have recourse to the printed words of prayer books. We do not need to assume that most inhibiting of all postures, kneeling, when we wish to send out thoughts aloft. We just transmit our thoughts of the moment, wherever we are and whatever we may be doing. Our enjoyment of the vast beauties of these realms, and the happiness which every single tiny element brings to us, are themselves a prayer to Him who gives them to us. In whatsoever we rejoice, according to our particular tastes and predilections, that rejoicing is an unspoken prayer, but a real prayer, nonetheless. 46. The state of happiness in which we in these realms are living is ever continuous. It never loses its savor by its constant presence. Our happiness never becomes stale, if I may so express it. It is an emotion of which we are forever aware, and the very consciousness of our happiness is transformed into an unexpressed prayer. Though unexpressed in so many words, it is powerful, and the great giver of these delights receives and responds to our unspoken prayer. By an outrageous perversion of the truth, the earthly church teaches that God demands, as his right, that all good people shall worship him, and praise him, and thank him for what he has done for them. Were such a shocking fiction even remotely true, how many people of the earth could possibly do any of these things when the picture of the Father of Heaven, as painted for you by the Church, is such a gross travesty? The Father of Heaven demands nothing of his children, whether they be of the earth world or of the spirit world. He does not demand worship, or praise, or thanks. He does not even ask for them. The beauties of these realms of the spirit world are living things. They respond to our love of them, and thereby they become still more beautiful. But the power behind all this beauty comes from one being only, and we are ever conscious of it. Being thus conscious of it, our feelings of gratitude are always with us. These feelings of gratitude are translated into thoughts of thanksgiving, and in our mind we glorify the giver, freely, without being told that we must do so. We magnify the name of the giver freely, without being told that he will be wrathful if we do not observe what he demands of us. The worship that we give him is the worship of true affection, and not the bowing down to an unknown God, whom the earth world is taught to fear, and who demands worship from his children as his right. Had the earth world not lived in spiritual blindness for so many hundreds of years, the inhabitants of it would by now know something of the rudiments of praying. They would know how to go about it without choking it with false doctrines, with sickly religious sentiment, with sanctimoniousness. They would know that true prayer is not a matter of the clergyman intoning in a pleasant voice, nor the gabbling of long extracts from the ancient writers. Knowing the proper method of saying prayers, the whole earth world would have benefited. The fact that prayer is regarded by so many earth people as a pious practice for those inclined towards religion has been brought about by the parody under which so much passes for real prayer. Prayer can be and is separated entirely from anything even remotely approaching organized religion. 47. That is how we use prayer in the spirit world. The Earth world could do precisely the same if it chose to do so. 48. The Lord's Prayer. A moment ago I referred to prayers which are so familiar that they can be recited from memory and without any effort of will, leaving the mind to think of whatever it likes. Of all such prayers, I'm inclined to believe that the Lord's Prayer is the most often said under such conditions. It has long been claimed that it is one of the most perfect of prayers, not only because it was given by Jesus himself, but because so much is contained within the compass of so few words. But whatever force the prayer might have is completely nullified by its customary thoughtless recital. There would seem to have become attached to the Lord's Prayer, in the minds of thousands of people, some out of talismanic power. It usually has a place in most of the organized recitals of prayers, seemingly by virtue of some prescriptive rite, as though the efficacy of any church service or private devotions would be greatly impaired if it were omitted. Now the very fact of its being so well known on earth that it can be recited by heart is also the measure, or at least one measure, of its inefficacy, for reasons that we are seeing, namely, the lack of mental concentration upon what is being said. That is fatal to any and every prayer, from the most sublime invocation to the most simple. The mind must be focused upon what is being said. The person who prays must know and understand exactly what he is saying, so that both knowing and understanding he can give sufficient directive force to his words and thoughts. It is really astonishing, as we see things from the spirit world, how many people fondly imagine that the bare repetition of words such as are contained, for instance, in the Lord's Prayer, is alone necessary to achieve its purpose. It is such folk who believe that this particular prayer, and others of a similar order, carries with it some magic power of its own. They may think that, because it is extracted from the scriptures, it will have some added property that no prayer composed by an ordinary person can possibly have. So it is that this prayer has been elevated to the front rank of set invocations. Let us, then, view the Lord's Prayer from the standpoint of the spirit world. Firstly, I would say that in so far as my experience of these realms is concerned, it is a prayer that we never employ. The principal reason for this is 49, that the sentiment contained within it does not apply to us here. Another reason is that we seldom or never make use of prescribed or stereotype prayers. Before we proceed further, I must make it clear that whoever composed this prayer, Jesus, with his great spiritual knowledge, was not the author of it. Jesus is presumed to have suggested to his hearer that they should pray after this manner, not necessarily using the words he gave, but after the fashion which he then proceeded to exemplify. The first feature we notice is brevity. The next is that the opening of the prayer is devoid of extravagant, excessive, and perforce, insincere adulation of the Father of Heaven, addressed specifically to himself. I have already spoken of this to you, and here in this prayer we have an ideal opening. Can it seriously be thought and believed that God would actually take pleasure in listening to the recitation of the long catalogue of his supposed superlative qualities? I say supposed qualities, because so much is attributed to the Great Father that has its origin in a total misconception of him. The adjectival preambles of most of the earth world's prayers are but a survival of paganism, when people worshipped gods of varying descriptions and of uncertain temper. The faithful of those remote days attributed most things to their deities, personal and national misfortunes, storms and other meteorological disturbances of whatever nature, all were ascribed to the wrath of the gods. It became vitally necessary, therefore, to address their deities in terms which they considered would please them most, thus throwing them into a good humor and placating them generally. They were under the delusion that what a god likes to hear most is a recital of his own sterling qualities. Once a pleasant relationship was thus established, the real object of the prayer could be proceeded with. This relic of paganism still resident in the minds of the great host of folk upon earth, and never more so than among orthodoxy and its exponents. The composers of prayers have followed this tradition. The Lord's Prayer, then, commences with the brief hallowed be thy name. Even this is not essential. It could easily be omitted from any prayer without impairing the value of it whatever. Thy kingdom come is a phrase that means nothing in the minds of most people. They say it because it is included in the prayer, and therefore its value is upon the same level as so much else, which is nothing more than mere theology. Churchmen teach that these words are the expression of hope, that all men will 50 come to know God, and that God's spiritual kingdom may be spread throughout the world. The very vagueness of the whole interpretation is revealed in its terms. Theologians will contend that the universality of God's kingdom can only come about through the spreading of the Christian religion. The latter then becomes the standard of spiritual knowledge and spiritual teaching by which the whole earth shall be governed, and the religious and secular affairs of its people conducted. The life that follows after death will be a Christian life, to be lived in all the perfection of true religious thought and knowledge, as gained through the Christian religion. Doubts are, of course, entertained concerning the fate of the heathen, the unbaptized, and, without doubt, those who practice communication with the spirit world. These latter folk are oftentimes regarded as beyond all hope. How are ecclesiastics to know, unless they have taken the trouble to ascertain that the spirit world is not an exclusively Christian world, that its inhabitants are here in these and other realms regardless of whether they were Christians or not, that the fact of their being Christian or not is a matter that is never inquired into, never heeded even, that whether they were Christians or not makes not the slightest difference to their spiritual status and the welcome they receive here in these realms, not the least difference to their spiritual prospects or means of attaining spiritual evolution and progression. How are people, especially the orthodox teachers of the earth world, to know, if they never trouble to find out that the spirit world contains in these realms of light, as well as in higher and lower states, individuals who, collectively, held every shade of non-Christian thought when they were incarnate? To pray, then, that the Christian religion may be spread throughout the whole face of the earth is not necessarily a good thing, because Orthodox Christianity embodies within it so much that is absolutely false. It will bolster up and support systems of living that are unquestionably wrong, as we see things in these realms. The historical record of organized Christianity is not a good one. The list of people who have had their earthly lives violently terminated in the name of Christianity is a horrible one. There is scarcely a religious denomination upon earth that does not claim its role of martyrs for the faith, whose transitions were encompassed by opposing sects. The kingdom of God does not include religious teaching accompanied by force, it does not include religious persecution, it does not countenance the use of the word heretic, it does not, in 51 fact, include much of what is in the minds of ecclesiastics when they hope for the coming of this kingdom. It is even believed by doctors of the church that the kingdom of God, when fully established, will witness the complete overthrow of Satan, and sin will thus be banished from the earth. Such beliefs, as these, are childishly crude. I freely confess that once I believed these things myself, when I was incarnate, and taught them. But those days are past, and I am now a happy resident of the spirit world, where we can see the precise value of so much that we embraced, as religious beliefs, before we came to dwell in these lands. Very well, then, I hear it objected. Tell us precisely what is the kingdom of God. Now you are asking me to explain something that has been invented by the earth world. It is rather you who could explain to me just what is meant by it. Beyond what I have given you as to its interpretation by churchmen, there is nothing that can be added that is of any consequence in further exposition. Later on I will suggest something to you that will, perhaps, throw a little light upon the joint relationship of our two worlds, yours and mine, and which light, if you wish so to regard it, be considered as giving some substance to the words "Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done." In this brief phrase is bound up the very essence of the whole prayer, because it is taught and believed upon earth that oneness prayers are answered or remain unanswered according to God's will. Indeed, the will of God is brought forward upon every occasion when some religious mystery presents itself. A prayer is not answered, therefore it is, because God's will ordains that it should not be answered. We are not worthy that it should be, that is what you would be officially told by a minister of the church when asked to explain why a prayer offered up in a deserving case has brought forth no response in kind. Thy will be done on earth, as it is in heaven. Resident in the minds of so many people is the thought that God's will is nothing, if not capricious. We cannot hope to know or understand His will, folk will say. Of course they cannot, for they have made of it such an impossible thing. They have made of it a scapegoat, an explanation for something which seemingly cannot be explained upon any other grounds. If they lose the physical presence of a dearly loved friend or relation through his transition in his early earthly life, then it is God's will that he should leave the earth plane, God's will that he should suffer from some dreadful ailment that 52 caused his passing. If people, or a whole nation, suffer a dire calamity, then it is God's will that it should be so. So a lengthy charter of disabilities, calamities, misfortunes, and disasters could be enumerated, any of which would be confidently attributed to the will of God. Would the same folk also ascribe to the will of God all the good things which they enjoyed? Would they say it is His will that they should enjoy a comfortable home in pleasant surroundings, enhanced by personal material prosperity? Would they attribute a perfection of summer weather to His will, just as they alleged that it was His will that caused a hurricane of wind or a devastating earthquake? Most people are inclined to think that the will of God is distinctly one-sided, indulging in calamities rather than in benefits. Who upon earth knows what is the will of God? Yet people pray for it to be done on earth, as it is in heaven, from which it must be assumed that they know what is God's will in heaven at least. It is so easy in the presence of some inexplicable event or happening to place its cause in the will of God. It attaches blame in a case where personal suffering is undergone, but the word blame is very much softened if it is disguised beneath the words "the will of God." How often is heard the cry in the midst of disaster, "I suppose it is God's will, and I suppose there must be some reason for it, but I cannot understand it. Why should this happen to me?" Not that such folk would assume some right of immunity from troubles of any kind, but because, so far, they had not encountered them, their lives had taken them along quietly upon an even course, untroubled by any major difficulties, but with an average proportion of minor difficulties that they were easily able to solve by their own ordinary endeavors. Then a greater tragedy overtakes them, apparently under the operation of the will of God, and they are nonplussed. The will of God has intruded into a happy and peaceful life, but for what sound reason it is impossible to understand. Yet those unhappy souls may have earnestly prayed for years, "Thy will be done on earth, as it is in heaven," and they would have assumed, presumably, that these apparent vagaries of will upon the part of God were the natural, everyday state of things in heaven, otherwise they would not have prayed for that particular exercise of divine will, as they did. Would it not be wiser, then, to try to discover what is the will of God in heaven before praying for its extension and operation upon earth? That, it would be objected, is impossible. How can anyone know what is the will of God? Just so. And in that case, were it not more expedient not to ask in 53 prayer for something about which we can know nothing concerning force or its power or its mode of operation, or, indeed, at what consequences might follow a full response to the request? Once again we see the remnants of paganism in all this confusion of ideas upon the will of God. In remote times, the same beliefs were held by man's ancestors upon earth in regard to his particular gods. These early gods were deities of very uncertain temper and temperament. They could smile or frown with equal facility and with equal reason or lack of it upon all people, regardless of their position's life. At all costs the gods must be propitiated, because it was they who dispensed alike benefits and misfortunes upon all people. It was their goddess' will that violent storms should sweep the countryside, that pestilences and plagues and famines should ravage the earth. They could never understand what it was impelled their gods to order such things, beyond the possibility, perhaps, that an insufficient number of sacrifices had been offered, or that there had been a general want of respect and reverence. Where these reasons could not be adduced, then it was merely the will of their gods that it should be so. When a multiplicity of gods were displaced in favor of one great God, these same absurd ideas were transferred to the Father of the universe. Orthodoxy has finally retained them within the body of its teachings, and the people themselves have entertained the same beliefs that have been handed down from their pagan ancestors. Again it may be countered, "You are supposed to be living in a heaven of some sort. Perhaps you could say, in broad terms, what is the will of God?" The heaven you inhabit may not be the heaven of theology, it may not be the heaven that a great many people have envisaged as paradise, it may even be better than that, it may be a heaven, in the contemplation of which, many folk may be displeased or disturbed, or even revolted. Whichever it may be, your happiness seems to be of a high order, and it is a happiness which is enjoyed by millions of other people, so you claim. Can you not tell us something of the will of God? I can, but I can only tell you very little, for the simple reason that there is really very little to tell. It is the earth people, led and inspired by orthodox teaching, who have made such an enormous factor of God's will. I have said to you before, but I must say it again, because, like so much that is extremely simple, the mere statement is apt to slip by almost unperceived, or with its full significance unrealized. 54. The will of the Father of the universe is that the whole universe of living things should be happy. The destiny of all mankind is ultimate, supreme, and unalloyed happiness, which, in the spirit world, will one day be enjoyed by every single soul that is born upon earth.